Accession number 4431, reel number 2.
Mr. Wallach, tape 2. Had you any idea when you were at Highton how long you would be there for?
No, we never had any idea of how long we were going to be interned for. The optimists kept on thinking that they might still be in time, if not for their exams, at any rate for the end of term. Some of them, after all, had tickets for their May week balls. And there was no indication at all. There was great relief that we could now communicate with our nearest and dearest. And since we were in Highton for slightly longer, let's say about a fortnight, a hierarchy began to build up in the camps. We had a camp leader and a group which under him and with him ran the camp to the satisfaction, we hoped, of the camp commandant. This led to the usual internal politics in organizations of this kind, where you have very little else to do. Very quickly we split into two groups, those who felt that they were Germans and refugees foremost, those who wished their German and refugee status not to be emphasized because they felt British. And as between those two groups, there was always a certain amount of argument and antagonism. And in Highton, it is fairly clear that the group of Jewish emigres preponderated considerably. There were several thousand people in Highton at the time, of whom our Cambridge group, which by now had been joined by Oxford and St. Andrews, were a comparatively small proportion. We never knew at any time when we were going to be released until the release finally came. From Highton, again in groups we were taken to the Isle of Man. There were two camps there, I believe. We were taken to Douglas, boarding houses on the seashore with barbed wire separating us from the sea, which in June was frustrating, although we later on were allowed to bathe under supervision. A faint recollection only of Highton, of long queues every morning for roll calls. In Highton I had met a man called Frank Varas, and I think his story is worth telling by itself, and I will, I think, do so now. He, as the name implies, was born of a German father and a Spanish mother, but his father had settled in Spain, and he had been brought up entirely in Spain, knew no German, and had been caught into the war when traveling back from South America in September or October 1939 on a Levantine steamer, having had a successful trip selling second-hand textile machinery in South America. The European blockade picked him up from his steamer, seeing that he was of German parentage, took him off, interned him in Gibraltar with five cabin trunks. Gibraltar had enough mouths to feed without having internees there as well, so as soon as possible he was shipped off, leaving behind two cabin trunks, and I met him in Highton, where he was perpetually asking for the Spanish consul, nobody paying any attention to him because he spoke Spanish only. I spoke a little Spanish. Perhaps that was one of the reasons why I got in touch with him rather more than most of the others. When we were transferred from Highton to the Isle of Man, again the orders were one suitcase only. Well, he only had three cabin trunks, so he left another two behind at Highton and was allowed to take one with him to the Isle of Man. When from the Isle of Man we were finally transferred to Canada, he very nearly was not allowed to take his cabin trunk with him because we were restricted to 40 pounds in weight, and his cabin trunk weighed a great deal more. Intervention with the camp commandant and explanation to him of how this man had already suffered considerable losses in his luggage succeeded in letting him take his cabin trunk with him. He travelled to Canada. In Canada, at the reception in Camp L, his cabin trunk was taken from him. He never saw it again, because when our belongings were returned, many things were not there. I'm sort of advancing my tale here a little to keep up with Frank Varas. He found himself 6 months after having been taken off a Levantine steamer off the Spanish coast with five cabin trunks, now in Canada without any luggage at all, dressed in a pair of slacks and a bathing costume because it had been warm when we were travelling up the St. Lawrence River. And he went a little off his head, as you might imagine, and caused a good deal of commotion and trouble, screaming for the Spanish consul, for anybody to help him in his extraordinary predicament, and was carted off, and that was the last I ever saw of him, to a Nazi camp as a troublemaker. Epitome of a wartime story, it seems to me, of the futility of the whole enterprise. Anyway, to get back to Huyten and from there to the Isle of Man. In the Isle of Man, we stayed only again a week or 10 days before we were told that some of us would have to go abroad to either Australia or Canada, and the selection was made partly by the camp administration, which was run by the refugees themselves, on the basis of orders issued, I think, by the Home Office probably, that the people to be selected for expatriation, if you like to call it that, were to be men under 30, preferably without family ties. Now, this meant that the university groups stayed very much together because, by definition, they were largely under 30 and they were largely unattached, though some of them claimed that they had fiancés, which did them no good. And so back we went to Liverpool, and brisk travel along the docks to a large ship, very large by comparison with what we had been transported to and from the Isle of Man in, called the Ettrick. And the first thing we heard when we boarded the Ettrick was that 2 days previously another similar ship called the Arundora Star had been sunk. We were told, without any survivors. We learned later that, in fact, there had been plenty of survivors, but I think well over 1,000 people were drowned in the Arundora Star, which was no great comfort to us, as we were shepherded down one deck after another, ending up right at the bottom in an area marked Sergeant's Suitcases, where we were going to spend the time. The top decks were inhabited mainly by prisoners of war in uniform, and right at the top, at the exit to the upper decks, there was barbed wire entanglements. So if this ship was torpedoed, there was no possibility that any of us could conceivably escape. It would not have been possible for us even to climb the stairs up there, never mind get out through the one exit, which was covered with barbed wire. We accepted that rather philosophically. We felt the British Navy, no doubt, would look after us, and sailed. But it did have several other disagreeable consequences. You had very little air conditioning in ships in those days. A certain amount of air came through the ventilation shafts, of course. But many people, I should say a majority probably, were terribly seasick. Rations were collected from above by details of people who brought them down. There were no arrangements, proper arrangements, for cleaning anything or for keeping anybody in order or anything in order. since seasickness does seem to incapacitate people very considerably, they were not able to look after themselves. There were elderly people, though not from our particular group, but surprisingly there were elderly people on board. And the first 3 or 4 days were very chaotic indeed. And then Frederick of Prussia, still going under his name of Herr von Lingen, organized a lavatory detail which kept the place reasonably clean in a, looking back on it, slightly fascist manner. It was all done by very firm orders and shouts, and we showed considerable contempt for those who seemed to be unable to help themselves or who were not looking after themselves properly. And I think our behavior must have offended a number of the less fit and less able and more elderly people there, but it did have the advantage of keeping the place reasonably clean. The Ettrick was quite a fast ship, and so our trip across the Atlantic took only about a week or thereabouts, and we were finally allowed up on deck on the last day when we were sailing up the St. Lawrence River. And it was very beautiful indeed. After a rather nasty time in England, we were now in calm waters, lovely sunshine, beautiful landscape, and landed at Quebec.
While you were on the ship, how were you treated by the military guarding you?
We were not treated by the military at all. The military never came down to us. Our sergeant suitcase hold was like one of the circles of Dante's Inferno, and anybody who didn't have to be down there didn't go down there. And in fact, our guards, knowing that there was no way in which any of us could get out of there except by opening a porthole and jumping out and drowning in the sea, left us entirely to our own devices. We had to do our own catering, our own cooking. We collected rations, I say, from one of the upper decks, and there were soldiers. But throughout that trip, I can't remember any British personnel ever venturing into our area.
But did you come into contact with them at all when you went to the
toilets?
Well,
we did. Yes, we did to the extent that they looked down, and the camp, we were still a camp organisation, and we still had a camp leader, was warned and told, look, you must clear up the Orgion stables you have down there. You must look after yourselves a little better. You are not coping very well. And, well, as a result of that, we tried to cope rather better in the...
Did they give you materials to help you?
Oh, yes. We had plenty of soap. We had mops. We had all we needed from that point of view. But it was not brought down. We collected it. And I can't remember any of these people ever coming down to us for an inspection or anything like that. But it may be that they did. This is a long time ago, and it is possible that they did come down. They must at least have known about the conditions, because otherwise they would not have cautioned us.
And how about your possessions? Did you lose anything?
In every camp, you were first searched, and your possessions were taken away from you. Most important razor blades with which you were supposed to be cutting your veins or arteries or whatever. And within a day or two, they were all returned to you again. You always got a receipt for them, and they were given back to you. On board ship, this was not done at all. You had what you had, and you kept that. After all, this was very much a transit affair, and nobody bothered about taking anything from you. But when we got to Canada, our first odd experience, in a way, was... I think it was the Toronto Scottish who received us there, and we had with us a group of 14 apprentice Roman Catholic priests in long black robes and those curious sort of elongated bowler hats, which the Roman Catholic clergy on the continent wears a good deal. Paradoxically, these youngsters were all supposed to have gone under their own steam to Australia to serve their apprenticeship there. And as you know, internment ships in fact went to Australia, but as the administration of the camps would have it, they went instead to Canada. And we were surprised as we were marched through the city of Quebec to the Heights of Abraham, where our camp was, to find these men rather roughly treated by the Toronto Scottish. The occasional rifle butt in the backside and shouts and get going and so on. When we got into better terms with our guardians a few days later, I asked one of the sergeants, "Now, why, after all, Quebec is a Roman Catholic province, why did you treat these men, who were obviously men of the cloth, noticeably more aggressively than you treated any of the others?" He said, "Well, we had been told that we were going to receive a number of fifth columnists who were too dangerous to keep in Britain, threatened by invasion, where they might act as a fifth column, and then their turn up, what alleged to be Roman Catholic priests or apprentice priests, and we took them to have been parachutists, German parachutists, landed in Belgium in disguise and captured there. We felt it was wicked of these people to use the cloth for such evil purposes, and that's why we treated them badly. Now we know different. That was the reason at the back of our minds." In this new camp, which was called Camp L, we were again frisked and had our belongings taken away for the time being, but with a, as we found later, significant difference. This time, though a list of our belongings was made, we were not given a copy, but were asked to sign this list and give it back to the people who'd compiled it, the Canadian soldiers. Some of us pointed out that this seemed an odd proceeding. We're told, "Look, this is the way we do things here, and you do what you're told, and that's it." We had no great option. 4 or 5 days later, we paraded and were supposed to be given back our belongings. A great many things had been stolen. No longer there, I lost a gold watch. Many others lost belongings of greater importance. As I already mentioned, Mr. Frank Varas lost the last of his cabin trunks altogether. And some of the stuff turned up later, I believe, in the city of Quebec. Restitution was made in money terms later on. It was a considerable scandal, this, and I believe you'll find it documented in the Home Office and so on. And it was an unpleasant surprise for us all. And,
who did you appeal to when you found this had happened? Did you have liaison?
There was no way of appealing to anybody at all. The camp commandant was a man called Colonel Wigg, and Colonel Wigg was prepared, through his adjutant, intelligence officer, to entertain and listen to complaints. In the first place, nothing happened at all, but we were at that time already writing to members of Parliament, prominent among those who were fighting our cause in the Commons was Eleanor Rathbone, of course, and Mr. Wedgwood Benn. And these people kicked up a stink in the Commons, I believe, and since there were a number of interesting and prominent people in our group, it caused a stir in Britain, and so gradually this percolated over to Canada, and things improved very considerably. But it was a very unpleasant start to Camp L. A pleasant start to Camp L was the rations. We were fed on Canadian Army rations, which was something gargantuan, I think. Half a pound of meat a meal, not a day, but a meal. And of course, we had nothing to do. We were not being treated as prisoners of war. We were not obliged to work. In fact, we were not allowed to work outside the camp as we had wished we might be. So there we were on the heights of Abraham, eating our heads off, living a life of Riley from that point of view, and with absolutely nothing to do except continue our studies such as they were, or entertain ourselves in one way or another, take in each other's intellectual and academic washing. I gave 26 lectures on Faust, which I never expected anybody to listen to, but everybody came because everybody was bored, and so they would do anything. I listened to a number of lectures on every conceivable subject. In some cases, I retained some of the stuff which I learned, and it was certainly academically the most stimulating organization you can possibly imagine. A really camp fraught with the intellect of, as I say, Oxford, Cambridge, St. Andrews, London School of Economics, Queen Mary College, and in addition to the people I've already mentioned, we had with us Klaus Fuchs, a man who could tell tales with a compelling interest of not academic but military kind. That was Hans Kahle, the former leader of the International Brigade in Spain. Very strange background his. He was in fact educated in a Prussian Kadettenanstalt and was an officer during the First World War. When the German army was disbanded, he was without a job. He sold vacuum cleaners and china and whatever people tried to sell in those days after the end of the war, when they were professional officers and out of a job. He got sick of it very soon. He became a socialist. He went and emigrated to Holland, and from there in the 30s went to Spain, organized the International Brigade, and was in fact the prototype to Hemingway's general and For Whom the Bell Tolls. He was also the head of the communist group or cell, which was nothing very secret at all. The intelligence officer in Camp L kept lists of various kinds, and one of the lists, because we were asked to type them in the internee's office, we had a number of typewriters at our disposal, was the group of communists there. And its leader was Hans Kahle, and his deputy leader was Klaus Fuchs. So there was never any doubt about either of those two and their political allegiances. And it was one of the oddities to hear later on, when Klaus Fuchs was condemned for passing atomic secrets to the Soviet Union, Mr. Attlee say in the Commons that nobody knew that he was a communist. Well, of course, everybody did know in that part of the world at any rate, and it's surprising that MI5 shouldn't have known as well, because the man there was an intelligence officer, and one would have thought that he kept these lists for that purpose and none other. However, Fuchs was, in fact, a very pleasant man. I found him shy, sometimes through his shyness a little abrupt, therefore not universally liked, I think, but I found him a pleasant companion, nice to talk to, and retiring, never talking about his own eminence. We knew that he was a very considerable physicist, but we knew it through others, never through him. He never showed off in any way. But I think that is all, really, I would like to say on that particular subject.
While you are on the subject, do you know, when he was released in Canada, did he go directly to the Atomic Research Department?
I don't know, no. I can't even recall whether he was in that first group of 160 or so who were released. I have a feeling he was, but I wouldn't swear to it. Certainly on academic distinction, which was one of the groups of release possibilities, he had every right to be released. But whether he was or not, I don't know. Hans Kahle also had served the war effort very well. He was one of Haldane's guinea pigs in experiments in underwater wave pressure, trying to find out what the effect of sea mines were on the human body. and had exposed himself to very considerable physical damage there. It never, in fact, happened. He went after the war to East Germany, became police president of the province of Schwerin, Mecklenburg-Schwerin, where he died. I don't think I ever saw him again after internment.
Going back to the Ettrick, the ship you came over, how long was the journey in all? Can you remember?
I think it was 8 days only. It was very brief, considering
all
things.
It was a fast ship. Well,
very
yes.
fast ship, and sailed singly, not in convoy, therefore was able to make use of its speed very well. And that is really all we knew, so we didn't suffer too badly. It seemed endless at the time, but I think it was only a week.
Thank you.